are now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
We are sponsored by Hover. And basically, Hover is domain management made simple. All right, it's the quickest way to establish and buy a domain name. You can do it under 5 minutes. And if you've ever registered a domain, you know the companies just try to upsell you stuff you don't need. I don't know if that ever happens to you. It's like, you want this? You want this option? No, I don't. I just want to do this, please. I just want to buy one domain. Thank you very much. And here's the best thing about Hover. They have a no-hold phone policy. You don't hold. You just get to somebody. It's fantastic. So if you ever run into a problem, you just call Hover, and a real live human being will answer the phone. Ah! Sorry, I'm getting excited. And by the way, you can get a .com domain, but guess what? You can also get a .net domain, which is totally underused, all right? So I always forget that. I'm always looking at .com, but in fact, you know, you can use a .net. I know a lot of people that are doing it. So I say, do it. It's easy. It's a pretty popular choice. And it's got lots of domain names available. So if you try for .com, go to .net. It might be available. Very important. And by the way, they also offer Google Apps. You can add Google Apps to your domain. Basically, you get everything you already love about the full suite of Google's productivity apps, Gmail, Calendar, Drive, Docs, the whole package. You already love and trust Google Apps for Gmail's 25 gigabyte storage and collaborating with chat and file sharing. I don't know if you know this, but Google is a huge company, so you can be, you know, they can be a little hard to get a hold of with your questions and concerns and support needs and things. But that's the best part. You get everything you love about Google Apps, but with the outstanding support of Hover. They make it easy, man. So I say it's a great solution for businesses. It's a very good company. Hover.com/Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, that is. You'll get 10% off. Come on now. Let's get back to the show. All right, everybody. This is the Brian Callen Show. And thanks for joining us. I'm with my partner in crime, Hunter Motz, as usual. For those of you guys in Springfield, Illinois, I'll be at Donnie B's Friday, Saturday, October 3rd and 4th, or I think it's 4th and 5th. Then I'll be at the Houston Improv, October 12th, 13th, 14th. Then I'll be in Helium in Buffalo. Beautiful Buffalo, New York,
Buffalo,
ladies and gentlemen.
Buffalo, Buffalo.
And then Calgary. Which is one of my favorite places. I was just in Toronto at the Just for Laughs Festival, and you Canadians, you laugh and you're incredibly polite.
And they love Brian Callen.
Yes, sir. I played out to Sony Theater, 3,000 people. It was you feel like a rock star, so thanks for bringing it, Toronto. Anyway, without further ado, we have a very smart man here who's written two fantastic books. Charles Mann, thank you for joining the Brian Callen Show, otherwise known as the BCS, sir.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, let's start with, you know, your books are fascinating. And one of the things that I found that I, you know, I've read Guns, Germs, and Steel and lots of things, but you really highlight the role that malaria plays on the history in the New World, on slavery. You talk about, I love the idea that when we talk about Italian food, what we're really talking about is fusion cuisine, because tomatoes originated in South America, as did potatoes. They didn't start in, I guess, Ireland. you know, these are the things you learn, and you learn how much other cultures and how much sort of the Columbian exchange, how these kinds of things really affect the way we live today. And that's what I want to kind of like, maybe we'll highlight that and talk a little bit about that. And also, you know, Native Americans and the role that disease played with the Native Americans and things. So thanks for writing these. They're fascinating books and a really great starting point, I think.
And such a great companion set, 1491 and then 1493.
Yeah. And we're going to, by the way, on our website here, we always feature the books. So you'll probably sell 1 million books. how long did it take you to write these books? And talk a little bit about your primary research, you know, your archival research and how you went about just, I don't know, writing these amazing books.
Well, I guess, you know, if I wanted to make it sound really impressive, I could say I spent 20 years on it. And it would sort of be true,
yep.
Sort of, in the sense that 20-some years ago, you know, my mother demanded that I come back to the home that I'd grown up in and deal with all the stuff that I'd left there since I went to college and so forth. And there's up in the attic was a whole bunch of stuff, including, to my chagrin, my 8th grade American history textbook from Highland Junior High School, which I had never returned.
Wow.
And
I love
and,
it.
You know, with like a $3 billion library book find, right? And so I opened it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there on the frontispiece was this picture, and it said, you know, the Americas before Columbus. And I looked at it, and I was kind of riveted because every single thing in the picture was wrong. I mean, it's kind of weird to see something like that where you look at it and you think, wow, that's what I was taught? Because, you know, it showed basically a bunch of guys with these weird hats on, you know, of different sorts.
Buckles on their hats, as my
brother. Yeah, and horns and so forth, like, you know, out of some kind of avant-garde version of a Wagnerian opera, and riding horses in the sagebrush. And you look at this and you think, wait a minute, nobody wore those hats. They didn't have horses because they came over from Europeans. And sagebrush even, you know, came over from Russia in the 19th century.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? I love this stuff.
Yeah. And I looked at this and I said, wow, this is what I learned. It was like totally off. And then there's a picture of Columbus. And the weird thing is, here's Columbus. He lands, you know, and this is, you know, the picture of Columbus. And everybody in it looks like George Washington. And there's no native people there.
Yeah.
You know, like when he landed, he was surrounded by all these people saying, hey, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow. And the reason is I'm a correspondent for Science Magazine in the news division. You know, from time to time, I've done stories for archaeology. And I thought, you know, the people that I talk to think that what their picture of our history is nothing like what I learned in Highland Junior. I mean, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, somebody should write a book. And it took a while for it to percolate that maybe I might try doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One of the things that Brian brought up, which I thought was the most fascinating, was the role to which that malaria played in the development of African slavery in the United States or in the Americas.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, one way to think about it is, in 1776, this great economist, Adam Smith, you know, sort of founded economics by writing The Wealth of Nations. You know, mm-hmm. we're too busy over here having our revolution to really notice, but he wrote this incredible book, which is basically the foundation of modern economics. And if you read the book, it's a great book. You find four or five times in this big, long book, Adam Smith tries to deal with slavery, and basically he cannot figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
He says, no, wait a minute. Look at these guys. You're dragging them over here. They don't speak your language. They're from tropical countries. They don't farm wheat over there. They're like, and they also, most important, they have no desire to work for you because they hate you.
Right. Mm-hmm. A historian said one time that the civil rights struggle began. He asked a bunch of historians, when do you think it began? Well, the Birmingham, 1963, and everybody had their different ideas. He said, wrong. It began when the first African slave was brought to the New World.
Yeah.
That's when the civil rights, nobody is a slave. You are put in slavery.
Right.
Right.
And they hate it. They hate it. Of course they do. I mean, you're taking their liberty. You're wrecking their family. I mean, you know, it's the worst thing you can imagine. They're like the worst workers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, why should they be good workers?
Yeah.
And so then he looks at this, Adam Smith does, and he says, wait a minute, we have indentured servants. And this is his deal that in the 17th century, the first two-thirds, about two out of three of the people who came to our country were indentured servants.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is you're a poor guy in England, you don't have any prospects, so you sign up and they pay for your passage, and then you work for 4 to 7 years over here for somebody, and then you get to go off and have you know, start your own farm.
Mm-hmm.
And that deal worked well for decades upon decades in England and France and so forth. And he said, why did they go for slavery? Why would they take Europeans who speak the language, know what to farm, and have an incentive to do a good job, and then replace them with these other people who cost more and, you know, hate you and want to kill you?
Mm.
He never comes up with an answer. And one of the things that was discovered in the 1970s was that malaria and yellow fever, which is this kind of other companion disease that usually goes along with yellow
and
fever.
But both indigenous, I think, to not just to Africa, but also to East Asia and things?
Yeah, malaria. Really, both originated. You know, they're really ancient diseases. They both originated, you know, a long time ago in Africa, but they've subsequently spread to other tropical places. And they're all spread. You know, they're all associated with certain types of mosquitoes.
And talk a little bit about the symptoms. I've seen it, but with my own eyes. I lived in Pakistan as a kid, and I remember watching one of the men who worked in on our compound. He had malaria. He was under 1,000 blankets, and he was going because he was freezing.
What happens with malaria? It's something that, you know, because we had this malaria eradication program, you know, Americans don't know much about, thank goodness, but it's a terrible disease. You know, it's the disease that you always hear that the Bill Gates Foundation is trying to fight in Africa, and 750,000 kids under the age of 5 die every year over there from it. And what it is it's a single-celled parasite called Plasmodium that lives in the mosquito. When the mosquito bites you, it injects unknowingly some of these cells into your body. They swim around in your bloodstream. They go through a bunch of changes, and eventually they change into a form that is able to pry open red blood cells. They crawl inside red blood cells where your immune system can't go after them. They multiply like crazy, and then in a coordinated assault, whose details we still don't really understand, they rip open all these red blood cells, and billions upon billions of them flood your body, and you feel awful.
God, it's a weird disease. Whatever. What a shitty disease. Like what?
No, it's just about the worst. It's the one disease I'm really scared of getting. And
it stays with you. Yeah, it stays with you. I mean, you know, you can. I know a guy who supposedly cured himself of malaria by exhausting himself. He would go for long, long runs and then take mass doses of, I think, quinine.
Yeah,
and actually was able, because what the organisms would, they sort of mutate, they stay in the liver, they hibernate in the liver, and then they would come out, and I guess the quinine killed it. I don't know. Malaria is curable.
It is curable, but, you know, it really knocks you out for a really long time.
Yeah.
And until quite recently, it would kill, you know, a substantial fraction of people who got it. And you'd have it for years. You know, because what would happen is you'd be sick for months, and then your body would gradually fight it off. The little bugs would retreat into your liver where they couldn't be seen by the immune system. And then 6 months later, a year later, bang, they'd come out, and you'd go through the whole cycle again. And it was just horrible. And what happened was that when Europeans came over to the Americas, they brought malaria with them, because people who had dormant stage malaria would come over, they get sick, and we have the right kinds of mosquitoes over here, and they would bite us, and the cycle started.
Wow.
But it's a tropical.
So the mosquitoes would actually contract the malaria pathogen by biting us, so you could actually give it to a mosquito.
You give it to mosquito, and it's a drag for the mosquito, but not nearly as bad as it is for us.
Yeah.
And then the mosquito goes and bites the next person, and that's how you get it. And this keeps happening, by the way. If you live around a major airport like the Reagan National or Dulles in Washington D.C. in a warm place, people come, they have malaria, they don't know it. A mosquito bites them, and then they give it. And this happens every few years. Somebody will get malaria in this way. And fortunately, we have the CDC and, you know, the National Institutes of Health and other people looking out for this.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very easily transmittable disease. And what happens is that when Europeans come, they inadvertently bring it over, and from Washington, D.C., all the way south, it becomes malaria country and yellow fever country, and Europeans can't survive there. It's just, you know, you bring over these indentured servants, and they all get sick, and you have to wait for a year or two to find out if they're going to kick the bucket or not.
Wow.
Meanwhile, you're feeding them, you're nursing them. So it suddenly becomes much, much more expensive to have European servants. Now, Africans, people from, you know, the malarial areas of Central and West Africa, are because they have lived, you know, and their ancestors have lived with malaria for so long, they
natural
have...
Natural immunity.
Natural types of immunities to them, both in genetic, and there's various forms of this. There's something called G6HD. There's something called sickle cell anemia. There's a whole bunch of them. They have these types of, and they also have acquired. When you get a certain strain of malaria, or you get it, or yellow fever, if you survive, you're immune to that strain forever.
Right.
You know, the way if you have chicken pox
or
once
hepatitis,
when you're a kid, you don't get it again, or hepatitis, that kind of thing. So over there, you have the world's largest pool of people who are immune to these diseases. And the great historian Philip Curtin calculated that at that point, it suddenly starts to make sense, economic sense. More economic sense to have slavery, because it's much better to have an unwilling worker who hates you than a dead one.
Wow.
Right.
That's amazing. You know, and to carry, to piggyback on what you're saying, I heard that the reason that African Americans in Africa suffered from such terrible AIDS, the AIDS epidemic it was a heterosexual disease in Africa, was because the Black Plague that went through Europe, those that survived had a certain genetic mutation in their body that made them more resistant to the HIV virus. Do you know anything about that?
I've heard that there's all these complicated cofactors. I don't know if that one particularly is true. But
yeah,
that,
they
isolated
a particular...
the kind of thing that happens, that you know, these diseases that happened in the past leave their genetic imprint in us.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, you know, in this particular case, you know, in a certain way, you could say that Africans who were, you know, more or less immune to malaria and were in some sense genetically superior, right, to Europeans, because
right.
they had these mutations that conferred resistance. But the odd thing was this was used against them in slavery, because it made them more valuable as slaves. And the logic of the system was, if you were a plantation owner and you said to bring over some indentured servants, you know, the way your parents might have, and the indentured servants died, you were out, whereas the guy next to you who brought over Africans would have prospered. In
wow.
this way, you know, the market kind of leaned its thumb in the direction of developing slave society.
This is amazing to me. I never knew this. I mean, you study history, and then all of a sudden somebody writes a book and comes up with this. It makes perfect sense. I mean, and I've just never heard anything like that. That's...
Yeah, there's lots of other factors, but this is a big one. I mean,
yeah.
you know, that you have to have types of plantations you have, you know, that grow these crops that need a lot of labor. There's a whole bunch of other factors in it. And there are plenty of places in which there could have been slave plantations, and there weren't, because people thought it was immoral. But you have the right set of circumstances, including the presence of these diseases, and it favors the creation of these. And so you have, between, you know, roughly speaking, the Mason-Dixon line is right where falciparum malaria, which is the worst kind of malaria, can survive. North of the Mason-Dixon line, it's too cold, and so it's an occasional presence. South of the Mason-Dixon line, it's there all the time.
So the Mason-Dixon line, which is the slavery line, is the same as the malaria line.
Right. It's a kind of a striking coincidence.
I like the way that... the next time somebody goes to the Mason-Dixon line, I'm going to be like, excuse me, it's called the Charles Mann/malaria line. All right. One of the turning points in American history, a lot of historians have argued, is the scourge of hookworm in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Outhouses really, really made a difference, because hookworm is still something that occurs in a lot of the developing world, which essentially gets into the intestine and creates a form of anemia. I mean, you mm-hmm. you are anemic and you have no energy. And so you had entire towns in the South, I think it was after the Civil War, that essentially were suffering from a complete lack of energy. They were all anemic because they had this hookworm, because they'd walk around in bare feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it made themselves even more vulnerable to malaria. And so you had these compounding effects where one disease would make you more vulnerable to the next. And
mm-hmm.
there's a number of historians who have argued that one of the reasons that the South, particularly after the Civil War, was so economically, you know, prostrate, you
yes.
know, especially in comparison to the North, was the fact that people were sick all the time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
They always say that if you're gonna come in and try to help a country develop, the first thing you've got to do is deal with the pathogens and the viruses and the bacteria that they
suffer
that's from.
Exactly. You see this in the modern sense where Bill Gates, his foundation, my understanding is they started off with the idea they're going to provide laptops to, you know, poor kids.
Start with
and
mosquito
development
nets.
Experts said, forget that. Yeah. Let's help us cure malaria. That's what they need.
That's mm-hmm. exactly right. That's exactly right. Talk a little bit about the sort of how nutrition and certain crops played a factor in you know, keeping people alive and productive.
Well, one of the sort of takeoff points is that there's a great French historian named Fernand Braudel. And
of course.
Fernand. I had cheese with him last week.
He's magnifique.
yeah. No, and he wrote these books, and he was one of these guys who knew, sort of was an encyclopedia, and he knew everything. And one of the things that he did is he compiled records of all the famines in Europe. And if you look at his stuff, it's pretty clear Europe could not feed itself. You know, people were just desperate. And then come these American crops, which are the big one is in the north, the potato, which comes originally from the Andes, and then in the south, meaning like Spain and Italy, you get corn, which originally comes from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just enormously more productive than what Europeans had. If you had an acre of wheat and you grew an acre of potatoes and you grew an acre of corn, you get the most food from the potatoes, the second most food from the corn, and way in the back would be the wheat.
Well, wheat is such a labor-intensive crop, too. You've got to separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will.
Yeah, no, you got to do all that.
Grind it.
The other thing is that if you're a really good wheat farmer, suppose that you guys are just like ace wheat farmers, which means that you get a lot of grain, right?
We get that all the time.
First of all, I don't eat gluten, but keep going.
Okay, well, or millet, or whatever you can eat. What that would mean is that you'd have lots and lots of grain, and the top of your plant, because remember, all these things grow on these little skinny stalks, would get heavy, and it would fall over. It's called lodging, and it kills the plant. And so in a certain weird way, if you're a really good wheat farmer, millet farmer, barley farmer, what have you, you're punished because you kill your plant. Now look at the potato. The potato is a tuber, right? It grows underground.
Mm-hmm.
It can get as big as it wants to, and the architecture of the plant doesn't care. And so there's these studies that were done by these 18th century sort of agricultural type reformers, and they found that somebody in England could grow roughly four times as much what they call dry food matter, which is when they get rid of the water, from an acre of potatoes than they could from an acre of wheat.
That's amazing. And the other thing is, I would imagine that when you grow a potato and an army comes in to take all your food.
Right.
They burn their crops,
exactly.
They can't do it. It's like, ha-ha, suckers, I'll just dig in the ground.
Right, you can keep potatoes in the ground for a really long time, and it's extremely inconvenient if you happen to be an army that's planning to steal from
a potato farmer.
The only disadvantage is that I like a wheat field, you can frolic through wheat. You can't frolic through a potato farm. That's the only thing I can say, but keep going.
Right, the all-important frolic market.
Yes, especially so I can allow my blonde locks to sort of, it's a wonderful contrast, but it's actually, it matches. It matches.
Right.
But potatoes do have beautiful flowers, right? And Marie Antoinette.
Flowers, actually, yeah. And they so what this meant is all of a sudden, if you think of it, Europe has a lot more food. And some poor guy in Ireland who's, sort of been barely making ends meet, what he can do is he can plant half his acre in potatoes and eat all that, plant the other half in something else, in wheat, and sell the wheat and, have a little bit of money. And so people are just much, much better off. And for the first time, Europe can really feed itself.
Hmm.
And you get these things where they say, look, when you have a country that can feed itself, you stop having things like bread riots.
Yeah.
Not having mobs of hungry people around. Like,
yeah.
You read Daniel Defoe novels, there's always these mobs, and they're always spelled M-O-B-B, the mob.
Yeah.
Which is, of all these starving people were running around. The place of disaster.
They say the Soviet Union collapsed because people just wanted to eat better. They got tired of waiting. I went to the Soviet Union in 1989, and I remember seeing bread lines. People were waiting in line for bread.
Yeah, exactly. People don't like this. And suddenly, when the governments get a lot more stable, and then these European governments, now much more stable, looked around, and what do governments like to do? They like to go over and conquer other governments.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The potato was, quite literally the fuel that produced, that fed these great European empires.
But it was really hard to get the potato adopted, right? There was a lot of resistance up front.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you're a very poor small farmer, and if your harvest fails, you're stuck. I mean, you don't have anything to eat. So you're very reluctant to try out stuff because the penalty for failure is so high.
Hmm.
And so it took a century or more before they were able to adopt this. And in fact, there are these various potato proselytizers. There's this guy in France called Parmentier who, sort of made it his career to promote the potato. And he was right. It made a huge difference.
Well, when we're talking about potato, are we also talking about yams and sweet potatoes? I know they have
kind of.
Yeah.
They're also from, yams and sweet potatoes. Yams, sweet potatoes, and potatoes are all different, right?
They're a different thing. But one is more, one is actually has a higher vitamin content, I think.
Yeah, the sweet potato, I think, has the highest of all of them. Yams are actually found in Africa and so forth. Sweet potatoes native to the Americas.
Mm.
And where that makes a difference is it goes to China. The sweet potato is carried across to China. And the deal with China is, if you look at a map of China, I went to this kind of like really, really terrible public school, like the kind, you know, when you hear people complaining about the public schools they go to.
Yeah.
That they're talking about my school.
I love people like you who come from public school, and all these people around when my neighborhood spent a fortune on private school. Do you want somebody to write two great groundbreaking books? Yeah. Send them to public school, but keep going, yeah.
Yeah, so mine wasn't that great, but, you know, and we never looked at maps. And so I didn't like look at a map until I was like 25, and I looked at this map of China. And there's a great thing about being ignorant is that really obvious things strike you for the first time. Mm-hmm. I looked at a map in China, and I looked at, to my surprise, there's no lakes in China. I mean, mm-hmm. We have like the Great Lakes, and
yeah,
there's no big bodies of water.
Just two big rivers.
Yes, these two big rivers, right? The Yangtze River and the Yellow River, and they're just on the eastern side of the country. So the whole western, I mean, China's this big country. The whole western part of it is these high hills and deserts. And then there's these two rivers that go through it. And so it turns out that China has something like, you know, 20% of the world's people and 7% of the world's, you know, above ground fresh water. And then on top of that, what do they want to grow there? They want to grow a crop. They want to eat a crop that has to be grown in a swimming pool.
Yeah, well, rice, yeah. And that is so labor intensive, yeah.
Yeah, it's super labor intensive. It has to be grown with massive amounts of water. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely nuts when you think about it.
Yeah.
Obviously, the governments are geniuses because they made it work for hundreds and hundreds of years. But anyway, around somewhere around 1600-1700, come in the sweet potato and corn, and these are really productive crops that you can grow in really dry areas.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, all these dry hills suddenly start looking good. And so there's this kind of go west, young man kind of thing, where the Ming Dynasty and then the one that followed it, the Qing Dynasty, basically pack up whole villages and send them off to the west to kick out indigenous people and start planting sweet potatoes, corn, and then later potatoes.
It's amazing.
And just, so there's this sort of parallel thing happening over there while we are doing the same thing, over in our neck of the woods. We're sending people to the west to kick out indigenous people and start planting our own planting crops.
Well, let me ask you a very quick question as a science writer. Can you basically live a healthy life on just sweet potatoes and one other thing? Like, say, I don't know.
Well, what depends. Basically, you can get all the nutrition, you need, except for, like, these trace elements on potatoes and milk.
Really? Potatoes and milk?
Yeah, you can get every, but you won't get, like, you need these trace micronutrients. So if you went to the health food store and we got some, trace micronutrient pills, then you could eat that. But you'd be bored out of your mind, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. But the Irish did it for a really long time.
And the same thing is true with corn. If you prepare it, in the tortillas in the native way, which is this procedure where you essentially soak them in lime, and that makes the niacin available to your body.
Oh, wow.
And you had that in beans, then you actually have everything you need. It's nutritionally complete, which means that you could live for a really long time on it, and then eventually you'd need stuff for your thyroid and stuff like that.
I was going to say iodine and stuff.
Yeah.
But basically,
they're good.
So basically, corn seeped in lime juice and beans will keep you alive.
It's not lime juice. It's lime.
Oh, and lime.
Yeah. And what you do
what
is
do you, mean,
you,
lime?
You make a tortilla.
Yeah.
It's like a chemical cousin of lye. It's not toxic, of course. And it breaks down the some of the simple way to say it is it breaks down some of the chemical compounds in raw corn to make them more... make them what they call bioavailable.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and then
wow, it's so funny how we live in California. I live in California, where nutrition is a religion, and people are eating. We just have such a varied diet. We're so lucky.
Right, and then you take to make a tortilla is basically you just crush these treated corn and flatten them and cook them.
Lime's a stone, isn't it? I mean, it's essentially
stone.
Yeah,
you grind them on stone, and then if you have beans and throw in some squash and avocado, you're good. You're good to go.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things, right? They were grinding this corn on this stone, but were they clear that the stone was what was making the niacin bioavailable, or was that just?
Well, they're actually soaked in lime. I don't think they were clear on this, but it might be simply that people who did this lived longer and better than people who did.
And I would imagine they ate. Some of them were eating game as well.
It was a pretty vegetarian diet. There wasn't that much game in Mexico, but there was lots and lots of different kinds of of plant seed. I mean, the people there are incredible plant breeders. Mm. And on the whole, they had considerably less, you know, hunger and famine than there was in Europe. It was altogether a more successful system. It wasn't perfect. I mean, there were bad famines from time to time, but it wasn't like Europe where, you know, there is a substantial fraction of the population on the edge of famine all the time.
Hmm. Well, and that's essentially because what you're seeing is it's the quality of technology, right? A plant is just a form of technology, and essentially the Native Americans had better technology than the Europeans.
Right.
When you put those two systems of technology together, you get something even better.
Right. I think that's often because, you know, typically cultures think about technology in terms of the kinds of technology that we're, that they are good at. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we in the U.S. were really good at gears and electronics and things like that, and so that's what we think tech is. But another kind of tech is plant breeding.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
these guys were geniuses at it, and they were better at it than Europeans. And so one of the wonderful things about, you know, people and different cultures and diversity and all that is that, you know, Europeans can go over and steal other cultures' ideas, and they can come over and steal our ideas.
It's mm-hmm. still going on. I mean, it's,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Only now we do it over Skype. Now you got now you got scientists sharing ideas over Skype, and one's in India and the other's in China or whatever.
Right.
And it, so it's just going on a higher level, for that matter. So is bioengineering food. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
right.
we're doing that. Talk a little bit about 1491. How much do we really know about the Americas before Columbus? I mean, one of the things that I've heard is that when we came in there, the say in the Mississippi Delta and those areas, there were thriving Native American populations. A small group of Spaniards come in, they leave, and when they come back, those areas are completely deserted because everybody's died probably of the diseases left behind by these European explorers. Is
right.
there what do we know about that for sure? And what do we mean? A lot of this is conjecture, right?
Well, it's the kind of, it's like a detective story. What we know is, like, for instance, the first European to make a, you know, a long expedition in, like, the American Southeast is De Soto, and he comes in the 1540s, and he lands in Florida and sort of staggers around, and it's the whole thing's a catastrophe, and ends up you know, around the Mississippi Delta.
I mean, Florida sucks now in a lot of places. I can't imagine in 1591. you ever been to Orlando? Anyway, but, yeah.
Well, anyway, so. And there's like three or four accounts that come from that of what he saw from, you know, eyewitness type accounts, you know, and they saw large populations thriving, you know, the cities. They were looking for gold. They didn't find any gold, but they found lots and lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, at one point they have to cross the Mississippi, and there's this huge town there, and they're terrified, and they figure out this way to get across. Now, then they come, and essentially very few Europeans come to this area for another century, and then LaSalle, you know, the French guy, floats down the Mississippi, and he goes right through that exact same area, and we have records of it, and there's nobody there anymore.
Wow.
Nobody for like 100 miles.
Was it possible that they were nomadic peoples?
Well, Soto describes settled cities. LaSalle mm-hmm. sees the ruins of some cities, and even more strange, LaSalle sees tons of bison.
Wow. You know,
all the way through there, and Soto doesn't ever record seeing these. Now, these were weird-looking beasts to Europeans. They'd never seen anything like it before. It seems unlikely that if there had been tons of bison around, that they wouldn't have ever noticed there are these giant, shaggy creatures that everybody's eating. And so the description of the landscape is really quite different. So what happened? Then, on top of that, there's archaeological evidence, lots and lots of archaeological evidence that these societies seem to be flourishing. They have these kind of earthen mounds. They're what they call late Mississippian societies, and they collapse right about they start having a hard time before De Soto comes in, and then they just seem to vanish right about that time.
Wow.
And you put it all together, and it looks like some catastrophe happened right about the time when the Europeans showed up. And then you say, in the cases that we know about, there are many, many cases in which Europeans inadvertently imported diseases and just wiped out populations.
Yeah.
And that just seems like the most likely explanation.
Influenza,
yeah.
Those kinds of
influenza,
diseases.
Influenza, measles, smallpox, diphtheria, typhoid, you just name it.
Yeah.
And then there's an archaeologist named Anne Ramanowski, who really is the first person to put all this together. And she argued that the the most likely vector for all this was the pigs. The Spaniards would come with pigs, and they were like a walking larder, right?
Right.
Bring them along, and he brought 600 pigs with him.
You mean on the boat, so they had something to eat?
Yes, so they had something to eat, and then they unloaded 600 boats in Florida, and then they ate them all the way through. And of course, it's recorded the pigs all escaped.
Oh boy!
And the thing is that pigs carry a zillion human diseases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Swine fever, etc.
Yeah, you just name it. There's just a whole list of them, and so. Obviously, when they were on the ship, they're not exactly carried in the most sanitary facilities.
Yeah.
And so you kind of like have 600 porcine typhoid Marys, you know, spreading through the spreading through the
600 porcine typhoid Marys. I'm putting that on a T-shirt. That's our new slogan. 600 porcine typhoid Marys. Everybody.
Kind of punk band would have that.
Yeah, that's a trivia question for the archives. Who said this on the Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show?
Or the most macabre version of a partridge in a pear tree ever. And 600 porcine typhoid Marys.
It doesn't fit into the song.
No,
dude.
Not at all.
It doesn't fit into the song. Oh, it's so funny.
One of the things that's so great about 1491 is that you do such a good job of really breaking down the myths that we have about Native Americans. You know, Native Americans, you look at the Land of Lakes package, you know, you look at that 1970s
crying Indian
advertisement. Yeah. You know, Indians have been mythologized in American culture, and you do such a good job of dealing with the reality that these are people,
right.
Rather than,
and you know, when you talk to Native people, it's annoying to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you know, I can't tell you the number of Native people who have said that, you know, they'll be standing there, and somebody will, you know, basically some well-meaning idiot will say, you know, essentially, are you feeling spiritual now?
Oh, God, that's so annoying. I know. Guess what? They're exactly like you. That's what I always say. People, I know that their situations are different and stuff, but you know, everybody basically wants to eat and have recreation time and watch their kids play.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, there's these, you know, in the past, there was these people, and I grew up in the small town in the West, and I certainly remember kids around me saying the most terrible things. Oh, they're all drunks, and you know, this kind of awful stuff. Even as a kid, I thought, whew, this seems, you know, that just seems really nasty.
Mm. They don't do well with the fire water, though. Let's be honest. Let's be honest.
I think that if you find a population that gets stripped out of everything that they own and gets shoved off into a corner and treated abominably, there's a certain number of people going to take to drink as a relief.
They really did suffer an apocalypse. I mean, they really did. If you look at the Native Americans to a tribe, arguably, they've just never recovered because the fabric of their society, you know, just from disease.
It's kind of amazing, actually, what you're looking at when you see, Native reservations is people who have really survived, extraordinarily bad treatment in every possible way for centuries.
It's
kind of amazing. You know, there's a series of TV movies that came out a couple years ago called We're Still Here, and I think that admirably does it. It's amazing that despite everything that European colonists threw at them, they're still here.
What did they – one of the things I've heard about the, you know, for example, the Blackfeet and stuff is that they never suffered from scurvy, even though they basically were carnivores. They lived on primarily game that they could catch.
Who is this? The
Blackfeet Indian or a lot of the Native Americans.
A lot of these societies did also were gatherers. The thing is that there's a lot of stuff to eat, and they gathered a lot of stuff. But also, meat has actually quite a bit of vitamin C in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you eat it raw or rare, yeah.
Yeah, right. And so they actually had, you know, a pretty good diet. And then before diseases came in the 19th century, there were records of the groups out in the West, and they were the tallest people in the world. And height is, you know, a pretty good proxy for general nutrition. These guys were doing pretty well.
I heard that. I heard the Blackfeet were huge. Look at the Maasai, the Bantu belt in Africa. They're giants, and they are primarily carnivores. I think the Maasai live on the blood from their animals, meat and milk.
And there's like this kind of you know, the big argument about among people who follow nutrition about whether you should eat meat or whether you should have a primary. You've heard this, like the Atkins diet and so forth.
Yeah, I've never seen a tall, healthy vegan personally, but keep going.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and these historical records of people like the Maasai and the Blackfeet is one of the reasons that the people who are in favor of the Atkins cite the idea that really a lot of meat is actually good for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's no question.
As I read,
of course, those guys exercised a lot more than
like
and,
all day.
And when you live just on wild game that you're catching, I've been hunting. Let me tell you, I had a high-powered scoped rifle, and it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. I was like, no wonder we farm cows. This is like trekking through. I did it for this TV show, and I did it with real hunters, not guys who sit in a stand who drink beer. These guys are real. Actually, know more about conservation and animals than anybody mm-hmm. you know. But it was such an experience to realize how hard it is just tracking and trying to get a bead on an
right.
animal. That's not easy to do. Forget it. I can't imagine doing it on foot with stone and bone and wood implements. Good luck. Good luck. Not easy.
I think what's so great about 1491 and 1493 as a companion set is that you really get a new narrative on race. You know, it really has all of the tools within those two books to be able to, you know, move past this problem that we basically haven't been able to solve in the United States' history of, you know, racism. And you suddenly really get a picture that people are people. You know, and that if you provide them with the right incentives, they'll, you know, be constructive. And if you provide them with perverse or wrong incentives, you know, they will do bad things. And that everybody has the same capacity for beauty and for, you know,
potential.
Yeah, everybody
an
has
appetite for potential.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that all human beings are going to react. I don't care what color you are. If I take a match and I burn you with it, you're going to react exactly
Absolutely.
The same way. You might scream in a different language, but basically,
the scream.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting is that you realize that when Columbus landed, Europeans didn't have what we think of as a concept of race.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't think that the people he encountered were like a different race. Mm. They didn't think that Africans were a different race, you know, in some sort of biological sense. Much more important to them was their religious faith, and they divided the world, you know, into Christians and non-Christians, and that was what was important. And you know, they also thought that if you were a non-Christian, if you were Muslim or something, or Jewish, you were taught things as a childhood that made it that literally changed your body and kind of stained you.
Yeah, that's
so
right. Yeah,
our conception of you know, quote, race is completely different from what they had in those days.
And well, I mean, didn't they get, weren't they sanctioned by the church, basically, the Spanish, but with the notion that you're going there essentially, yes, to explore, but also to convert these
yes.
quote unquote savages?
Right. Right. And the question is, who are these people and where did they come from? And, you know, they don't seem to be in the Bible. And so they thought, essentially, most of them, beginning with this guy named Acosta, that these were the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel.
Wow.
They were Jews.
Wow.
And so consequently, you know, your goal is to convert them and turn them into good Christians. And the popes actually allowed, you know, said it was okay for the Spaniards to go and conquer with the idea that they would then go and convert everybody and turn these Jews into good Christians. And so our conception that they're going after Indians, you know, which and the idea is that Indians are a separate, you know, human race is very, very different from what they had. And this starts only our conception only starts evolving in the 18th and 19th century, partly from slavery, where you start bringing these people from Africa, and then you have to construct a justification for what you do it, and then you say, well, they're just a different type of person than us,
right?
And then the modern doctrines of race and so forth come as a, you know, after justification for something that people were already doing.
Wow, it's amazing, man. This has been a learning. You know, just when you
and
think
so this
you know
is
stuff.
Kind of why you know biologists, when you ask them about race, they kind of want to bang their heads against the wall, because for them, you know, we think it's this biological entity, and they say, well, look, supposedly if there is this unit, there should be like a package of genes, right?
Right.
That everybody who belongs to one race or another should share. Well, what is it? Is it having super curly hair? There's tons of people in Africa who don't have super curly hair, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Is it being tall, being short, having really light skin, really dark skin? There's tons of people in Africa who don't fit any of these things. And the same thing is true. We say Indians, you know, people in South Asia,
yeah,
are the same, quote, race as people in Sweden. But of course, they don't look anything alike, and so mm-hmm.
that's why they say when you do your genome and you want to see if you've got something in, you know, whatever you've mm-hmm. got, they're like, look, you've got genetic material from all over.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, the idea that you're going to be able to isolate and say, I'm actually originally from Italy. I'm a pure Italian.
Yeah.
It's not the case. I'll tell you what I got from this whole discussion is that the Native Americans were actually red Jews. I mean, that's well, this is the one thing I'm taking away from this entire discussion,
which Joseph McCarthy had figured out back in the 1950s.
Yeah. Charles, man, I know you have to go and give a speech or get some kind of a talk as academics like yourself do, as science writers.
Actually, I'm not an academic. I'm a journalist, but there's a school near us of landscape architecture where they've asked me a long time ago to give a talk to them about what the Americas looked like before Columbus.
Really?
Oh, that's awesome.
America, really? And give us
the landscape.
Before you run, what was the landscape? How was it?
Well,
different?
The people here, you know, we kind of think, you know, we learned from Thoreau and John Muir and others so forth that there is a wilderness here.
Yeah.
But in fact, there's all these people here, and people, what they do is they like to change the world around them to make it better for them. And so,
right,
you know, the whole East Coast is lined with farms.
Mm-hmm. You mean back in the day?
I mean, back in the day, you know, before.
Do we have any idea what kind of a population there was when?
Well, it turns out to be one of these arguments that people have been having for a long time, and so there's a big dispute on it. You know, it seems to me that the sort of general estimate, but there's certainly some people who tell you this is wrong, is that at the time of Columbus landed, there is somewhere between 40 and 60 million people here in the Americas.
Really? That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
40 and 60 million.
I should say that those numbers keep rising. And
wow.
So just as a personal guess, this is just a guess, I wouldn't be surprised if when it all sort of shook out that the number didn't go up to 80 million.
I'm shocked by that. I'm shocked by that. That's amazing.
A lot of people here. There's a lot of people here. And so when these diseases came through, you know, Europeans unknowingly imported these diseases, and there may have been, you know, 90% loss, 95% loss even. You're looking at the worst demographic catastrophe in the history of humankind. There's been nothing like it before or since, thank God.
I think about what that must have been like. We know what happened to the Native Americans as the buffalo were killed off in a period of like 30 years, and we know that catastrophe. But there was a much bigger catastrophe after 1491.
Yeah, and it's just remarkable that their society survived. I mean, just think of what would happen. There's a great historian, Alfred Crosby, who, you know, was one of a real pioneer in describing all this, and he pointed out that, you know, the Black Death came and killed a third of the people in Europe. If Genghis Khan had come right then, you and I would not be speaking Indo-European language, because no society can withstand that kind of blow.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. That's just incredible to me. That's just, you know, what a disaster. And, you know, one of the things that they say the Native Americans kind of, the other thing that sort of defeated them was the notion that, look at what's happening to us. Look at this disaster. Our gods must not be as strong as their gods. Either our gods.
It was a tremendous spiritual crisis. And, you know, just think of what happened after the Black Death. It's no accident that the Black Death is followed, you know, by Protestantism and this tremendous split in the Christian Church that, you know, resounds to the present day. You know, the religious authorities lost a huge amount when their God failed to protect them in this.
I never thought of that. I'm learning a lot today.
You have this huge spiritual crisis. I mean, on top of everything else, you know, just a two-thirds population loss, or, you know, 90% population, it's horrifying. And then, you know, of course it leads to a spiritual crisis. What has happened? These are not people who have a germ theory of disease. Neither did Europeans. And so they both interpret it in the same way, which is Europeans said, our gods must be better than theirs. And they said, wow, their gods must be better than ours, at least in a certain number of cases. And so you get this phenomenon of large-scale conversions.
I'm just so glad I was born in the 20th century and the later 20th century, 21st. It's amazing to me, man. There it is. If you want to know the role that germs and food technology played in our history. Pick up 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus by Charles Mann. And then there is the wonderful companion piece to the book, 1493. And you can almost, I would say, start your history with these two books and be a long way. Charles
Absolutely.
Mann, keep up the good work. What's the next book for you?
It's sort of hard to describe, so I'll just say it's somewhat different. It doesn't have a number in the title. I've run out of numbers. It's called The Wizard and the Prophet, and it's a nonfiction book. And
wow.
If I'm lucky, maybe you'll find it interesting enough to have me back on your show.
You have a standing invite because we didn't get enough time with you. I know you have to run off and do your speech on architecture. be more diverse while you're at it. But I really appreciate you coming on here, man. This is the kind of thing that we love because people, you listen for 45 minutes and you come away with a whole new perspective. I know I have. So
Thank you very much.
It's
a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah,
guys.
Man. But, seriously, anytime you want, we're going to keep in touch with you and we'd love to have you back. And even, you know, even before your book comes out, we'd love to talk to you.
That's generous of you.
I mean,
thank you.
It's great, man. So, Charles, man, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Hunter Motz. Hunter Motz, again, the reason we have a guy like that on. Hunter Motz, not me. It's amazing, dude. It's amazing. We're just gonna keep this train going, man. I'm just loving this. That was a really
so much fun, right?
Accessible,
yeah.
And learned guy who, you know, I read a lot of history. You do too, but that's a learning experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
I never thought of the bubonic plague and the role it played in the Protestant Reformation.
Absolutely. I mean, it laid the foundation, right?
Yeah, and by the way, started a 100 years war. more death.
Yeah.
More destruction. More hunger.
But it's interesting because I mean, you know, the whole thing starts off with him talking about his history textbook, and usually what we see in our, you know, middle school, high school history textbooks is that it's all people did this,
yeah.
As opposed to like, no, a disease came in and everyone was like, WTF.
Dude, you know, and by the way, for all you people who are anti-vaccine, shut up. Pick up 1491 and 1493 or any history book. Seriously. It's like, I was thinking about that as he was talking. I was like, you know, I've never gone hungry. I was a wrestler, so I used to purposely starve myself to lose weight. But, you know, I never had to worry about, oh, I don't know, measles, mm-hmm. diphtheria, a serious influenza strain, smallpox. What a blast. Blisters on the outside and inside of your body. Hey, I'd love to see my kid die of that. Imagine that. Imagine the misery quotient you were dealing with then.
Well, and think about what it does to your worldview, what it does to your horizons.
I mean,
if you're like, I could die at any minute, how much long-term planning are you doing?
Yeah. Now, for me, it's like I'm into, you know, I lose my sunglasses and I'm like, my day sucks. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you where I'm going to be again, stand-up-wise. My phone's dead, but I'm going to be in Donnie B's, Springfield, Illinois, October 4th and 5th. I'll be in the Houston Improv, which is a great room, October 13th, 14th, 15th, or something like that. Go to briancallen.com. And then I'll be in Buffalo the next weekend, the 17th, 18th, 19th or something, and then I'll be in Calgary at the end of October. You better bring it. I will be. I know I will be. Hunter Motz, thank you once again. Rena,
thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for your wonderful engineering and your fantastic looks. and it was nice and hot in here, and I like it. We're talking live from the network studios.
Ba-pow.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.